the sun rise above the hills to the east of the house, when the voice came, seemingly from nowhere.
Rowan?
It was a reedy quaver, barely audible, and yet somehow loud enough to echo around the silent kitchen, and it made me jump so that scalding coffee slopped over my wrist and the sleeve of my dressing gown. Shit! I began mopping up, twisting at the same time to see the source of the voice. There was no one there, at least no one visible. Who's there? I called, and this time I heard a creak from the direction of the stairs, a single creak, so eerily like those of the night before, that my heart skipped a beat. Who is it? I called again, more aggressively than I had intended, and strode angrily out into the hallway. Above me, a small figure hesitated at the top of the stairs. Ellie. Her face was worried, her lip trembling. Oh, sweetheart. I felt instantly contrite. I'm sorry, you scared me. I didn't mean to snap. Come down.
I'm not allowed, she said.
She had a blanket in her hands, twisting the silky trim between her fingers, and with her bottom lip stuck out and wobbling dangerously close to tears, she looked suddenly much younger than her 5 years. Of course you are. Who says you're not allowed?
Mummy, we're not allowed out of our rooms until the bunny clock's ears go up.
Oh. Suddenly I remembered the paragraph in the binder about Ellie's early rising and the rule about the happy bunny clock, which clicked over to the wide-awake bunny at 6 a.m. I looked back through the arch to the kitchen clock. 5:47. Well, I couldn't exactly contradict Sandra's rule, but here we were, and there was a large part of me that was relieved to see another human being. Somehow, with Ellie around, the ghosts of the night before seemed to retreat back into absurdity. Well, I said slowly, trying to pick my way between backing up my employer and compassion to a small child hovering on the verge of crying. Well, you're up now. Just this once, I think we can pretend the bunny woke up early.
But what will Mummy say?
I won't tell anyone if you don't, I said, and then bit my lip. It's one of the cardinal rules of childcare. Don't ask a child to keep secrets from a parent. That's the path to all kinds of risky behaviour and misunderstandings. But I'd said it now, and hopefully Ellie had read it as a light-hearted remark rather than an invitation to conspire against her mother. I couldn't help but glance up at the camera in the corner. But surely Sandra wouldn't be awake at 6 a.m. unless she had to be. Come on down and we'll have a hot chocolate together, and then when the bunny wakes up, you can go up and get dressed. Down in the kitchen, Ellie sat on one of the high stools, kicking her heels against the legs of the chair, while I heated up milk on the induction hob and stirred in chocolate powder. As Ellie drank and I sipped my now cooling coffee, we talked about school, about her best friend Carrie, about missing the dogs, and at last I ventured to ask about whether she missed her parents. Her face crumpled a little at that.
Can we phone Mummy again tonight?
Yes, of course. We can try, anyway. She's been very busy, you know that.
Ellie nodded.
Then, looking out of the window, she said,
He's gone, hasn't he?
Who? I was confused. Was she talking about her father or Jack? Or perhaps someone else.
Who's gone?
She didn't answer, only kicked her legs against the stool.
I like it better when he's gone. He makes them do things they don't want to do.
I don't know why, but the words gave me a sharp flashback to something I had barely thought about since my very first night here. That crumpled, unfinished note from Katya. The words sounded inside my head as though someone had whispered them urgently into my ear. I wanted to tell you to please be. Suddenly it felt more like a warning than ever. Who? I said, more urgently this time. Who are you talking about? Ellie? But she misunderstood my question, or perhaps deliberately chose to misinterpret it.
The girls.
Her voice was matter-of-fact. And then she put down her hot chocolate and slid from the stool.
Can I go and watch some TV?
Ellie, wait, I said, standing too, feeling my heart suddenly pounding in my chest. Who are you talking about? Who's gone? Who makes the girls do things? But I was too urgent, and as my hand closed on her wrist, she pulled away, suddenly frightened by my intensity.
Nothing? I don't remember. I made it up. Maddie told me to say it. I didn't say it anyway.
The excuses tumbled out one after another, each as silly as the one before, and she twisted her small hand out of my grip. I had no idea what to say. I thought about following her as she slipped from the room and the sound of the Peppa Pig theme tune filtered back into the playroom, but I knew it wouldn't work. I had scared her and missed my chance. I should have asked more casually. Now she had closed down in that way small children do when they realise they have said something more momentous than they meant to. It was the same panic I had seen in little children when they repeated an inappropriate word without understanding the reaction it would elicit, a startled attempt to backpedal from a response they had not anticipated, followed by total shutdown and a denial that they ever said it. If I pushed Ellie now, I would only be shooting myself in the foot and preventing any further confidences.
The girls. He makes them do things they don't want to do.
My stomach turned over. It was the kind of thing every safeguarding manual warned about. The nightmare scenario you hoped never to encounter. But was it? What girls was Ellie talking about? Herself and Maddie? Or some completely different girls? And who was the he? Bill? Jack? Or someone else entirely? A teacher or... But no. I pushed away the image of the wild, grief-stricken face staring out of my phone screen at me. That was pure fantasy. If I went to Sandra with something like that, she'd be entitled to laugh in my face. But could I go to Sandra with something like this? When Ellie would deny what she said and when it might be nothing at all? There was nothing that I could pinpoint after all to say this is definitely worrying. I was still staring after Ellie, biting at the edge of my nail, when a noise from the hallway made me jump, and I turned to see the door opening and Jean McKenzie standing on the doorstep, taking off her coat. Mrs. McKenzie, I said. She was neatly dressed in a woollen skirt and a white cotton blouse, and I suddenly felt very conscious of my own state of undress in a dressing gown with not a great deal beneath.
You're up early, was all she said,
and I felt the prickle of her disapproval. Maybe it was the lack of sleep, or the leftover anxiety from Ellie's words, but my temper suddenly boiled up. Why don't you like me? I demanded. She turned to look back at me from stashing her coat in the hall cupboard.
I beg your pardon.
You heard me. You've been completely off with me ever since I arrived. Why?
I think you're imagining things, miss.
You know full well I'm not. If it's about that business on the first day, I didn't shut the damn door. And I didn't lock the children out. Why would I?
Kindness is as kindness does,
Jean Mackenzie said cryptically, and she turned to go into the utility room, but I ran after her, grabbing her arm. What the hell does that even mean? She pulled herself out of my grip, and suddenly her eyes blazed at me with what I could only call hatred.
Oh, thank you not to handle me like that, miss, and not to swear in front of the bairns either.
I was asking you a perfectly reasonable question, I retorted, but she ignored me, stalking away to the utility room, rubbing her arm with exaggerated care as if I'd given her a friction burn. Stop calling me miss, I called after her. We're not in bloody Downton Abbey.
What would you prefer me to call you then? She snapped over her shoulder.
I had turned on my heel, preparing to wake up Maddie, but her words stopped me in my tracks, and I swung round to stare at her expressionless back, bent over the utility room sink.
What did you say?
But she did not answer, only turned on the taps, drowning out my voice.
Goodbye, girls, I called,
watching them through the school gate as they traipsed into their classrooms. Maddie said nothing. She just trudged onwards, head down, ignoring the chatter of the other little girls. But Ellie looked up from her conversation with a little red-headed girl and waved. Her smile was sweet and cheerful, and I felt myself smile back, and then down at Petra, jiggling and gurgling on my hip. The sun was shining, the birds were singing, and the warmth of a beautiful June day was filtering through the leaves of the trees. The fears and fantasies of last night, the memory of that twisted, grief-racked face peering out from the screen of my phone, all of that seemed suddenly preposterous in the light of day. I was just strapping Petra back into her car seat when my phone pinged, and I glanced at it, wondering if it was something important. It was an email. From Sandra. Oh, shit. Paranoid thoughts flitted through my mind. Had she seen the camera footage of me almost hitting Maddie? Or the endless stream of treats I had been bribing the girls with? Or was it something else? Something Jean Mackenzie had said? My stomach was fluttering butterflies as I clicked to open, but the subject header was matter-of-fact enough. Update, whatever that meant. Hi, Rowan. Sorry to email, but I'm in a meeting and can't talk, and I wanted to send you a quick update with how things are going here. The trade fair has gone super well, but Bill has been called away to Dubai to do some troubleshooting out there, which means I'm going to have to take over the Kensington project. Not ideal, as it means I will be away for a little longer than I had hoped, but it can't be helped. I should be back by next Tuesday, i.e. a week today. Are you managing okay? Does that sound doable? In terms of the children, Rhiannon finishes school today. Elise's mum has kindly volunteered to collect both girls. They live down near Pitlochry, so have to drive past anyway. And Rhi will be back at Heatherbrae any time from about 12 onwards. I have texted her so she knows what's going on, and she's excited to meet you. Jack spoke to Bill yesterday and mentioned that you are getting on very well with the girls. I'm very glad to hear it's all going okay. Do call if you have any concerns. I will try to ring tonight before the girls' bedtimes. Sandra, kiss. I shut down the email, unsure whether my overriding emotion was one of relief or trepidation. I most definitely was relieved, not least about the fact that Jack had apparently put in a good word for me. But another week? I had not realised until I read Sandra's words how much I had been counting on her arrival back this Friday, ticking off the days in my head like a prison sentence. And now,
4 more days added onto my term. And not just with the little ones, but with Rhiannon too. How did I feel about that? The idea of having someone else in the house was undeniably comforting. There was something absurd about the memory of those slow, measured footsteps, but even in daylight, I could feel the hairs beginning to rise up on my arms as I recalled lying there, listening to them pacing back and forth. Having someone, even a stroppy 14-year-old in the next bedroom, would definitely take the edge off. But as I started up the Tesla, the image that flashed through my head was a different one. That scarlet scrawl across the bedroom door, "Fuck off, keep out or you die." There was something there. Something very close to Maddie's furious, wordless anger. Perhaps, whatever it was, I would be able to get to the bottom of it with Rhiannon. The school run back to Heatherbrae took longer than the previous morning because there was a van on the road ahead of me. I followed it slowly from Carnbridge, tapping gingerly at the accelerator, sure that it would turn off at every junction we came to, but inexplicably it seemed to be going the same way, even as the road narrowed and grew more rural. It was with some relief that I realised we were nearly at the turn-off to Heatherbrae House, and I was just about to signal left when the van signalled too and drew up over the drive, forcing me to stamp on the brakes. As I waited, the Tesla silently idling, the passenger door opened and a girl jumped out, a rucksack on her shoulder. She said something to the driver and the back door of the van popped open. She dragged a huge case out, thumping it carelessly onto the gravel, and then slammed the door and stepped back as the driver pulled away from the curb. I was just about to lean out and ask her who she was and what she was doing in the middle of nowhere, when she pulled her phone out of her pocket and held it up to the proximity sensor of the gates, and they swung open. It couldn't be Rhiannon, surely. She wasn't due back until the afternoon, and that disreputable van certainly didn't look like it belonged to anyone's mother. Was it someone who worked here? But in that case, why the huge trunk? I waited a few minutes for her to clear the gates and then pressed on the accelerator. The Tesla slid smoothly up the drive behind the girl, who turned with a look of surprise on her face. However, instead of moving out of the way, she stood her ground, hands on her hips and the huge case at her feet. I braked again, feeling the gravel scrunch beneath the tyres, and wound down the window. "Can I help you?"
"I should be the one asking you that," the girl said.
She had long blonde hair and a clipped, expensive accent without a trace of Scots in it.
"Who the hell are you and what are you doing in my parents' car?"
So it was Rhiannon. "Oh, hello, you must be Rhiannon. Sorry, I wasn't expecting you back for another few hours. I'm Rowan." The girl was still looking at me blankly and I added, beginning to feel a little impatient, "The new nanny? I thought your mum told you." It seemed stupid to be carrying on this conversation through a car window, so I put the car into park and got out, holding out my hand. "Nice to meet you. Sorry not to be expecting you. Your mum said you wouldn't be here until 12.
"Rowan, but you're..."
the girl began, a furrow between her narrow brows, then something cleared and she shook her head. There was a smile on her lips, and it was not a very nice one.
"Never mind."
"I'm what?" I dropped my hand.
"I said, never mind," Rhiannon said. "And don't pay any attention to what my mum told you. She hasn't got a fucking clue which way is up, as you may have already realised."
She looked me up and down and then said,
"Well, what are you waiting for?"
"What?"
"Give me a hand with my case."
I was getting more and more irritated, but there was no point in starting off on the wrong foot. So I swallowed my anger and wheeled the case around to the back of the Tesla. It was even heavier than it looked. Rhiannon didn't wait for me to load it up, but climbed into the back seat beside Petra.
"Hello, brat," she said,
though there was an undertone of affection in her voice that had been notably absent when she spoke to me. And then, to me, as I slid into the driver's seat,
"Well, let's not sit here all day admiring the view."
I gritted my teeth, swallowed my pride, and pressed down so hard on the accelerator that gravel spat from behind the wheels as we began to move up the drive towards Heatherbrae House. Inside the house, Rhiannon stalked into the kitchen, leaving me to unload both Petra and the huge heavy trunk. When I finally made it inside, Petra in tow, I saw that Rhiannon had already installed herself at the metal breakfast bar and was eating a giant sandwich he had clearly just put together.
"So,"
her voice came out like a drawl,
"you're Rowan, are you? I must say, you don't look anything like what I was expecting."
I frowned. There was something a little malicious in her voice, and I wondered what exactly she meant.
"What were you expecting?" "Oh, I don't know, just someone different. You don't look like a Rowan somehow."
She grinned, and then before I could react, took another bite of sandwich and said, thickly, through the mouthful,
"You need to put more mayonnaise on the fridge order. Oh, and where the hell are the dogs?"
I blinked. I felt like it should be me asking the questions, grilling her. Why did I always seem to be on the wrong end of a power struggle? But it was a perfectly reasonable question, so I tried to keep my voice even as I answered it. "Jack was called away to take some paperwork to your dad. He took the dogs with him. He thought they'd enjoy the trip." That hadn't been what he'd said at all, but somehow I didn't want to admit to this haughty teenager that I hadn't felt equal to the task of wrangling three small children and two Labradors.
"When's he back?"
"Jack, I don't know, today, I imagine." Rhiannon nodded, chewing thoughtfully, and then said, around a mouthful of food,
"By the way, it's Elise's birthday tonight, and her mum's invited me over for a sleepover. Is that okay?"
There was something in her tone that made it clear that I was being asked only as a formality, but I nodded. "I'd better text your mum and check, but of course, that's fine by me. Where does she live?"
"Pitlochry. It's about an hour's drive, but Elise's brother will give me a lift."
I nodded, pulled out my phone, and texted a quick message to Sandra. "Rhiannon, safely back, wants to go to a sleepover with Elise tonight. Assume that's okay, but please confirm." The message pinged back almost straight away. "No problem. We'll call 6 p.m. Give my love to Rhi." "Your mum sends her love and says it's fine," I reported back to Rhiannon, who rolled her eyes as if to say, "Well, duh." "What time are you getting picked up?"
"After lunch," Rhiannon said.
She swung her legs over the side of the stool and shoved the dirty plate across the counter towards me.
"Laters."
I watched her as she made her way up the stairs, long legs in school uniform stalking up the graceful curve of the staircase, and then disappearing around the bend. She did not come down for lunch. I wasn't particularly surprised, given the sandwich she'd eaten a couple of hours before. But since I was making lunch for me and Petra, I felt like I should at least ask if she wanted to join us. I tried to speak to her using the intercom function, but it refused to connect. Instead, a message pinged back via the app.
"Not hungry."
Huh. I hadn't even known it could do that. "Okay," I messaged back. As I was putting my phone away, another thought occurred to me, and I pulled it back out of my pocket and reopened the Happy app. Feeling a little queasy, I clicked on the menu that showed the list of cameras available for me to access. As I scrolled down the list to R, I told myself I wouldn't look, but at least that way I would know. But when I got down there, Rhiannon's room was greyed out and unavailable, which was mostly a relief. There would have been something inexpressibly inappropriate about cameras in a 14-year-old girl's bedroom. It was as I was spooning yogurt into Petra's eager mouth, dodging her helping fingers as she tried to grab the spoon, that I heard footsteps on the stairs and peered into the hallway to see Rhiannon holding a small bag in one hand and her phone in the other.
"Elise's brother's here," she said abruptly.
"At the door?" I glanced automatically at my phone, puzzled. "I didn't hear the bell."
"Duh, at the gates." "Okay," I resisted the urge to bite back a sarcastic retort. "I'll buzz him in."
My phone was on the counter, but I'd barely even opened up the app, let alone navigated the menu of the various gates, doors and garages I had access to, before Rhiannon was already halfway to the door.
"No need."
She pressed her thumb to the panel and then swung open the front door.
"He's waiting for me down by the road."
"Wait." I moved the yogurt out of Petra's reach and then ran hastily after Rhiannon. "Hang on a sec. I need a number for Elise's mum."
Why?
Rhiannon said, heavy with sarcasm, and I shook my head, refusing to get drawn into her defiance.
"Because you're 14 years old, and I've never met the woman, and I just do. Do you have it? If not, I'll ask your mum."
"Yeah, I've got it." She rolled her eyes, but pulled out her phone and then cast around for a bit of paper. One of Maddie's drawings was lying on the stairs, and she picked it up and scribbled a number on the back.
"There. Happy?"
"Yes," I said, though it was not entirely true. She slammed the door behind her, and I watched through the window as she disappeared around the curve in the drive, and then looked down at the piece of paper. The number was scribbled across one corner along with the name Cass, and I tapped it into the Messenger app on my phone.
"Hi, Cass, it's Rowan here. I'm the Ellencourt's new nanny. I just wanted to say thank you for having Rhiannon tonight, and if there's any problems, please call or text this number. If you could let me know what time you'll be dropping her off, that would be great. Thanks, Rowan."
The reply came back reassuringly quickly while I was spooning the last of the yogurt into Petra.
"Hi, nice to meet you. Pleasure, it's always nice to have Rhi over. I imagine we'll have her back by lunchtime tomorrow, but let's play it by ear. Cass."
It was only when I went to put Maddie's drawing back on the stairs that I finally looked at it. It reminded me of the drawing I'd found on the first night, of the house and the pale little face staring out. But there was something distinctly darker and more disturbing about this one. At the centre of the page was a crude figure, a little girl with curly hair and sticking out skirt, and she seemed to be locked inside some kind of prison cell. But when I peered at it more closely, I realised it must be meant to represent the poison garden. The thick black bars of the iron gate were scored across her figure, and she was clutching at them with one hand and holding something in the other. A branch, I thought, covered in green leaves and red berries. Tears were streaming down her face. Her mouth was open in a despairing wail, and there were red scribbles of blood on her face and on her dress. The whole image was encircled in thick, black, spiralling lines, as if I was staring down the wrong end of a telescope into some kind of nightmarish tunnel into the past. On the one hand, it was just a little girl's drawing, no different from the sometimes violent scribbles I had seen at the nursery. Superheroes gunning down baddies, policemen fighting robbers. But on the other, I don't know. It was hard to put my finger on what made me recoil. But there was something so indescribably nasty about it. So chilling and so full of satisfaction and glee in the macabre subject matter that I let the paper drop from my fingers to the floor as if it had burned me. I stood there, ignoring Petra's increasingly irritable cries of,
"Don't! Don't! Put that down now!"
behind me and stared at the picture. I wanted to screw it up and throw it away. But I knew what the child protection advice at Little Nippers would have been. Put the drawing on file. Flag concerns with the safeguarding officer at the nursery. Discuss the issues raised in the drawing with parents, guardians, if deemed appropriate. Well, there was no safeguarding officer here except me. But if I were Sandra, I was pretty sure that I would want to know about this. Where Maddie was getting this stuff from, I wasn't sure, but it needed to be stopped. Feeling more disturbed than I wanted to admit, I picked the drawing up and slid it carefully into one of the drawers in the study. Then I returned to the kitchen and set about cleaning Petra up and putting her down for her nap. I hadn't meant to fall asleep in Petra's room, but I woke with a start, the armchair's gingham cover wet with drool beneath my cheek and my heart pounding for reasons I could not put my finger on. Petra was still slumbering in her cot as I struggled upright, trying to figure out what had happened and what had woken me so abruptly. I must have drifted off while waiting for her to fall asleep. Had I... Shit! The thought came like a sudden punch to the solar plexus. Had I slept through school pickup? But no. When I checked my phone, it was only 1:30. Then it came again. The noise that had woken me from sleep. The doorbell. "Doorbell sounding," flashed my phone. And then, "Open door. Confirm. Cancel." A Pavlovian jolt of dread flooded through me, and for a moment I sat there paralysed, half dreading, half expecting the creak, creak to commence as it had last night, but it didn't. And at last I forced myself to move. I swung my feet to the floor and stood up, waiting for my blood pressure to settle and my heart to stop drumming with panic in my ears. As I did so, I wiped the corner of my mouth and looked down at myself. It was only a few days since I'd turned up, note perfect, in my rendition of Rowan the Perfect Nanny, in her tweed skirt and neatly buttoned cardigan. I looked far from perfect now. I was wearing crumpled jeans and my sweatshirt was stained with Petra's breakfast. I looked much closer to the person I really was, as if the real me was leaking out of the cracks in the facade, taking over. Well, it was too late to change now. Instead, I left Petra sleeping peacefully in her cot and made my way down the stairs to the hallway, where I pressed my thumb to the panel and watched as the door swung silently open. For a second, it seemed like a continuation of last night. There was no one there. But then I saw the Land Rover parked across the driveway, heard the retreating crunch of gravel, and peering round the side of the house, I saw a tall, broad figure disappearing towards the stables, two dogs bounding at his heels. "Jack!" I called, my voice croaky with sleep. I cleared my throat and tried again. "Hey, Jack, was that you?"
"Rowan!"
He turned at the sound of my voice and came striding back across the yard, grinning widely.
"Yes, I rang the bell. I was going to ask if you fancied a cup of tea, but I thought you must have gone out.
No, no, I was... I paused, unsure what to say then in view of my sleep-crumpled face and draggled clothes, decided maybe the truth was best. I'd fallen asleep, actually. Petra's down for her nap and I must have drifted off. Well, I didn't get a very good night's rest.
Oh, were the girls playing up?
No, no, it's not that, it's... I paused again and then screwed up my courage. It's those noises I was talking about. From the attic, I got woken up again.
Jack, you know those keys you mentioned?
He was nodding.
Aye, sure, no problem. Want to try it now?
Why not? The girls were at school. Petra would probably nap for at least an hour longer. It was as good a time as any. Yes, please.
I'll have to hunt them out. Give me 10 minutes and I'll be with you.
Okay, I said. I felt better already.
The chances were there was a simple explanation for the noise and we were going to discover it. I'll put the kettle on. See you in 10 minutes.
In the event, he was back sooner than 10. A tangle of rusty keys in one hand and a toolkit in the other, a big bottle of WD-40 sticking out the top. The dogs followed him in, panting excitedly, and I found myself smiling as I watched them sniffing diligently around the kitchen, hoovering up all the scraps the children had dropped. Then they flopped down on their beds in the utility room as though the whole trip had exhausted them beyond measure. The kettle had just boiled, and I poured out 2 mugs and held one out to Jack. He shoved the keys in his back pocket, took it, and grinned.
Just what I needed. Do you want to finish the teas down here or take them up?
Well, Petra's still asleep, actually, so it might be a good idea to crack on before she wakes up.
Suits me,
he said.
I've been sitting in the car all morning. I'd rather drink on the go.
We carried everything carefully upstairs, tiptoeing past Petra's room, although when I peered in, she looked like she was out for the count, sprawled like someone dropped from a great height onto a soft mattress. Up in my bedroom, the curtains were still drawn, the bed rumpled, and my worn clothes were still scattered across the soft, wheat-coloured carpet. I felt my cheeks flush, and putting down my cup, I hastily picked up my bra and knickers from the night before, along with a blouse, and shoved them into the laundry basket in the bathroom before opening the curtains. Sorry, I said. I'm not normally such a slob. That was totally untrue. Back at my flat in London, the majority of my underwear lived in a pile in the corner of the room, washed only when the clean pairs in my drawer ran out. But here, I'd been trying hard to keep up the image of meticulous neatness. Apparently, it was slipping. Jack, however, didn't seem bothered and was already trying the door in the corner of the room.
It's this one, is it?
Yes, that's right.
And you've tried all the other cupboard keys?
Yes, all the ones I could find.
Well, let's see if any of these match.
The ring he was holding held maybe 20 or 30 keys of varying sizes, from a huge black iron one, which I guessed must be the original key to the gate, before the electric lock had been installed, through to small brass ones which looked like they might be for desks or safes. Jack tried a medium-sized one which fitted through the hole but rattled around loosely inside, plainly too small for the lock, and then a slightly larger one which fitted but did not turn all the way. He squirted the can of lubricant inside the lock and tried again, but it still turned only a quarter of the way and then stopped.
It could be jammed, but if it's the wrong key, I don't want to risk forcing it and breaking the shank in the lock. I'll try a few more.
I watched as he tried maybe 4 or 5 others of the same size, but they were worse.
either not fitting in at all or jamming before he'd managed even a quarter turn. At last he seemed to make up his mind and returned to the second key he'd picked out.
"This is the only key on the bunch that has any give at all, so I'll try it again with a bit more force, and if it breaks, well, we'll just have to get the locksmith in. Wish me luck."
"Good luck," I said, and he began to force the key. I found I was wincing preemptively as I watched him apply pressure, first gently and then harder, and at last so hard that I could see the shaft of the key bending slightly, the round bow at the top twisting, twisting. "Stop!" I cried, just as Jack gave an exclamation of satisfaction and there was a noisy scrape and click, and the key completed the full turn.
"Got it!"
He stood, wiping the lubricant off his hands, and then turned to me with a mock courtly bow.
"Do you wish to do the honours, milady?"
"No!" The word was out before I could think better of it, and then I forced a laugh. "I mean, I don't mind. It's up to you. But I warn you, if there's rats, I'll scream." It was a lie. I'm not afraid of rats. I'm not afraid of very much, normally. And I felt like the worst kind of female cliche sheltering behind the big, strong man. But Jack had not lain there night after night, listening to that slow, stealthy creak, creak above his head.
"I'll take one for the team, then,"
he said with a very small wink, and he twisted the handle, and the door opened. I don't know what I expected. A staircase disappearing into the darkness. A corridor hung with cobwebs. I found I was holding my breath as the door swung back, peering over Jack's shoulder. Whatever I expected, it wasn't what was there. It was just another closet, very dusty and badly finished so that you could see the gaps in the plasterboard, and much smaller and shallower than the one where I'd hung my clothes, but a closet nonetheless. An empty bar hung, slightly lopsided, about 6 inches down from the ceiling, as if awaiting hangers and clothes.
"Huh,"
Jack said. He tossed the keys on the bed, looking thoughtful.
"Well, that's weird."
"Weird? You mean, why lock up a perfectly usable closet?"
"Well, I suppose so, but what I really meant is the draft."
"The draft?" I echoed stupidly, and he nodded.
"Look at the floor."
I looked where he pointed. Across the floorboards were streaks where a breeze had plainly forced dust through the narrow gaps, and looking more closely at the stained and dusty plasterboard, I could see the same thing. When I put my hand to the gap, there was a faint, cool breeze, and the same dank smell that I had noticed coming from the keyhole last night when I had peered through into the darkness.
"You mean there is something back there, but someone boarded it up?"
He moved past me and began rummaging in his toolkit, and suddenly I was not at all sure that I wanted to do this. "Jack, I don't think...
I mean, Sandra might..." "Ah, she won't mind. I'll board it back up more neatly if it comes to it, and she'll have a working closet instead of a locked door."
He took out a small crowbar. I opened my mouth to say something else, something about it being my bedroom, about the mess, about... But it was too late. There was a crunching noise, and a slab of plasterboard toppled forward into the room so that Jack only just got out of the way. He picked it up, carefully avoiding the rusty nails that were sticking out of the edges, and propped it against the side of the closet, and I heard his voice echoing now as he let out a long, satisfied, "Ah."
"Ah, what?"
I said anxiously, trying to peer past him, but his big frame filled the doorway, and all I could see was darkness.
"Have a look,"
he said, stepping back.
"See for yourself. You were right."
And there it was, just as I had imagined. The wooden treads, the swags of cobwebs, the staircase winding up into darkness. I found my mouth was dry, and my throat clicked as I swallowed.
"Do you have a torch?"
Jack asked, and I shook my head, feeling suddenly unable to speak. He shrugged.
"Nor me. We'll have to make do with phones. Mind your feet on those nails."
And he stepped forward into the blackness. For a moment I was completely frozen, watching him disappear up the narrow stairs, the beam of his phone a thin glimmer in the black, his footsteps echoing, "Creak, creak." The sound was so close to the noise of last night, and yet there was something different about it, too. It was more solid, more real, faster, and mixed with the crunch of plasterboard.
"Holy shit,"
I heard from above, and then,
"Rowan, get up here. You've got to see this."
There was a lump in my throat as if I was about to cry, though I knew that I wasn't. It was pure fear that had lodged there, silencing me, making me unable to ask Jack what was up there, what he had found, what he needed me to see so urgently. Instead, I switched on my phone torch with fingers that shook and followed him into the darkness. Jack was standing in the middle of the attic, staring open-mouthed at his surroundings. He had switched his phone off, and there was light coming from somewhere, a thin, grey light that I couldn't immediately locate. There must be a window somewhere, but that wasn't what I was looking at. What I was looking at were the walls, the furniture, the feathers. They were everywhere, strewn across the broken rocking chair in the corner, in the dusty cobwebbed crib, over the rickety doll's house and the dusty chalkboard, across the pile of smashed china dolls piled up against the wall. Feathers. Feathers. And not down from a burst pillow, either. These were thick and black. Flight feathers from a crow or a raven, I thought. And there was a stench of death, too. But that wasn't all of it. It wasn't even the worst of it. The strangest thing was the walls, or rather what was written on them. Scribbled on all of them, in childish crayon letters, some small, some huge and scrawled, were words. It took me a minute or two to make them out, for the letters were misshapen and the words badly spelled. But the one right in front of me, the one staring me in the face over the small fireplace in the centre of the room, was unmistakable. "We hate you." It was exactly the same as the phrase Maddie had spelled out in her alphabetti spaghetti. And seeing it here, in a locked, boarded-up room she could not possibly have entered, gave me a jolt to the stomach as if I'd been punched. It was with a kind of sick dread that I held up my phone torch to some of the other phrases.
The ghosts do not like you.
They hate you. We want you to go away. The ghosts are angry. They hate you. Get out. They're angry. We hate you. We hate you. Go away. We hate you.
Again and again, small and large, from tiny letters etched with concentrated hate in a corner by the door, to the giant sprawling scrawl above the fireplace that I had seen when I first entered. We hate you. The words had been bad enough, sliding in slimy orange juice across a plate. But here, scrawled in a demented hand across every inch of plaster, they were nothing short of malevolent. And in my head I heard Maddie's little sobbing voice again, as though she had gasped the words in my ear. The ghosts wouldn't like it. It was too close to be coincidence. But at the same time, it was totally impossible. This room was not just locked, it was boarded up. And the only entrance was through my own bedroom. And without question, someone else had been up here, and it had not been Maddie. I had heard those relentless, pacing footsteps just moments after staring down at Maddie's sleeping form. Maddie had not written those words, but she had repeated them to me, which meant... was she repeating what someone had whispered to her?
Rowan?
The voice seemed to be coming from a great distance, hard to hear beneath a shrill buzzing coming from inside my own skull. Through the ringing, I felt a hand on my arm.
Rowan? Rowan! Are you okay? You look a bit strange.
I'm okay, I managed, though my voice was strange in my ears. I'm all right. It's just... oh, God, who wrote that?
Kids messing about, don't you think? Then, well, there's your explanation for the noise.
He nudged with his foot at something in the corner, and I looked to see a pile of mouldering feathers and bones held together by little more than dust.
Poor wee bastard. Must have got in through the window and couldn't get out. Battered himself half to death trying to escape.
He pointed to the opposite wall, to a minute window, only a little bigger than a sheet of paper. It was grey with dirt, and part way open. Letting go of my arm, Jack strode over and slammed it shut. Oh, oh my God. I found I couldn't catch my breath. The ringing in my ears intensified. Was I having some kind of panic attack? I groped for something to hold on to, and my fingers crunched against dead insects, and I let out a strangled sob.
Look, Jack said practically, seeming to make up his mind. Let's get out of here, get you a drink. I'll come back in a bit, clear up the bird.
Taking my hand, he led me firmly towards the stairs. The feel of his large, warm hand in mine was unspeakably reassuring. And for a moment I let myself be pulled towards the door and the stairs, back towards the main house. But then something inside me rebelled. Whatever the truth of this attic, Jack was not my white knight. And I was not some terrified child who needed protecting from the reality of what lay behind this locked door. As Jack turned sideways to edge between a pile of teetering chairs and a dried-up paint box, I took the opportunity to pull my hand out of his. Part of me felt I was being ungrateful. He was only trying to be reassuring after all. But the other part of me knew that if I fell into this role, I might never escape it. And I could not allow Jack to see me that way, as yet another hysterical, superstitious woman hyperventilating over a pile of feathers and some childish scribbles. And so,
as Jack disappeared down the stairs towards the floor below, I made myself stop and turn, taking a last long look back at that dust-shrouded room, filled with smashed dolls and toys, broken furniture, and the spoiled debris of a lost childhood.
Rowan?
Jack's voice came from down the stairs, hollow and echoing up the narrow corridor.
Are you coming?
Yes, I said. My voice was cracked and I coughed, feeling my chest tighten. I'm coming! I moved quickly to follow him, filled with a sudden dread of the door shutting, being trapped up here with the dust and the dolls and the stench of death. But my foot must have caught on something, for as I reached the top of the stairs, there was a sudden rushing clatter, and the pile of dolls shifted and collapsed in on itself, china limbs cracking against each other with ominous chinks, dust rising up from threadbare moth-eaten dresses. Shit, I said, and watched horrified as the little avalanche subsided. At last, all was quiet, except for one single decapitated china head rolling slowly towards the centre of the room. It was the way the warped floorboards bowed, I knew, but for a crazy second, I had the illusion that it was pursuing me and would chase me down the stairs, its cherubic smile and empty eyes hunting me down. It was just that, though, an illusion, and a few seconds later it came to a rocking halt facing the door. One eye had been punched out, and there was a crack across one pink cheek that gave its smile a curiously mocking appearance. "We hate you," I heard in the corner of my mind, as if someone had whispered it in my ear. And then I heard Jack's voice again, calling me from the bottom of the stairs, and I turned and followed him down the wooden steps. Stepping out into the warmth and light of the rest of the house felt like returning from another world. After a trip into a particularly dark and nightmarish Narnia, perhaps. Jack stood aside to let me out, and then shut the door behind us both and locked it. The key screeched in protest as he did so. Then we both turned and made our way down to the bright, homely comfort of the kitchen. I found my hands were shaking as I tried to rinse out the teacups and put the kettle on to boil. And at last, after a few minutes of watching me, Jack stood up and walked over to me.
"Sit down and let me make you a cup for a change. Or would you prefer something a wee bit stronger? A dram, maybe?"
"Whiskey, you mean?" I said, slightly startled, and he grinned and nodded. I gave a shaky laugh. "Bloody hell, Jack, it's barely lunch."
"All right then, just tea. But you sit there while I make it. You're always running around after those kids. Have a sit down for a change."
But I shook my head, stubborn. I would not be that woman. I would not be one of those other four nannies. "No, I'll make the tea. But it would be great if you could..." I paused, trying to think of a job he could do to soften the refusal of help. "If you could find some biscuits." I remembered giving Maddie and Ellie jammy dodgers after the shock of the speakers going off in the middle of the night. "Sugar is good for shock," I heard my own voice saying, as if I were a frightened child, able to be jollied back to cheerfulness with a forbidden treat. "I'm not normally like this," I wanted to say, and it was true. I wasn't superstitious. I wasn't nervy. I wasn't the kind of person who saw signs and portents around every corner and crossed themselves when they saw a black cat on Friday the 13th. That wasn't me. But for 3 nights now, I'd had little or no sleep, And no matter what I tried to tell myself, I had heard those noises, loud and clear, and they were not a bird, whatever Jack thought. The senseless, panicked crashing of a trapped bird, that would have been scary enough, but it was nothing like the slow, measured creak, creak that had kept me awake night after night. And besides, that bird was dead, long dead. There was no way it could have been making noises last night, or any night for a while. In fact, judging by the smell and the state of decomposition, it had probably been up there for several weeks. The smell. It had stayed with me, fusty and choking in my nostrils, and as I carried the tea across to the sofa, I found I could still smell it, even though I'd washed my hands. It clung to my clothes and my hair, and glancing down, I saw a long streak of grey on the sleeve of my jumper. The sun had gone in, and in spite of the underfloor heating, the room was not particularly warm, but I shrugged the sweatshirt off and put it aside. I felt that I'd have frozen rather than put it back on. "Here you go." Jack sat beside me, making the springs of the sofa squeak, and handed me a rich tea biscuit. I dipped it automatically into my tea and took a bite and shivered. I couldn't help myself.
"Are you cold?"
"A bit. Not really. I mean, I have a jumper, it's just I didn't. I couldn't..." I swallowed then, feeling like a fool. I nodded at the streak of attic dust I'd noticed on the sleeve. "I can't get the smell of that place out of my head. I thought maybe it was in my sweater."
"I understand,"
he said quietly. And then, as if reading my thoughts, he stripped off his own jacket, streaked with cobwebs, and laid it aside. He was only wearing a T-shirt underneath, but in contrast to my chill, his arms were warm. So warm that I could feel the heat from his skin as we sat, not quite touching, but uncomfortably close on the small two-seater sofa.
"You've goose pimples all up your arms," he said.
And then, slowly, as if giving me time to move away, he put out a hand and rubbed the skin of my upper arm gently. I shivered again, but it was not with cold. And for a long moment, I had an almost overwhelming urge to close my eyes and lean into him. "Jack," I said, at the same time as he cleared his throat and the baby monitor on the counter let out a crackling wail. "Petra. I'd better go and get her." I stood, setting the tea down on the counter, and then staggered as a sudden wash of dizziness came over me from standing up too fast.
"Hey,"
Jack stood too, putting a hand on my arm, steadying me.
"Hey, are you all right?"
"I'm fine." It was true. The moment of faintness had passed. "It's nothing. I get low blood pressure sometimes, and I'm just... I didn't sleep well last night." Oh, I had already told him that. He was going to think I was coming apart, adding amnesia to my list of frailties. I was better than this, stronger than this. I had to be. I badly wanted a cigarette, but the CV I had handed in to Sandra had said non-smoker, and I couldn't risk unpicking that particular thread. I might discover everything unravelled. I found myself glancing up towards the ever-watching egg-shaped eye in the corner of the room. "Jack, what are we going to tell Sandra?" I asked. And then the baby monitor crackled into life again, this time a more determined cry that I could hear both through the speaker and coming down the stairs. "Hold that thought," I said, and sprinted hastily for the stairs. 10 minutes later, I was back down with a freshly changed Petra, grumpy and blinking, and looking as tousled and confused as I felt. She glowered at Jack as I came back into the kitchen, her little hands gripping my top like a small marsupial. But when he chucked her under the chin, she gave a little reluctant smile, and then a proper one as he pulled a funny expression, laughing and then twisting her face away in that funny way children do when they know they're being charmed into good spirits in spite of themselves. She let herself be settled in her high chair with some segments of Satsuma, and then I turned back to Jack. I was just saying, Sandra and Bill, we have to tell them about the attic, right? Or do you think they know?
I'm not sure,
Jack said thoughtfully. He rubbed his chin, his fingers rasping over dark auburn stubble.
They're sort of perfectionists. The way that cupboard was boarded up inside didn't look like their work. And I can't imagine they'd leave all that crap up there. Sorry, excuse my French, Petra,
he said formally, giving her a little mock bow. All that rubbish is what I meant to say. They cleared the house when they moved in, from what I understand. I didn't start work until a couple of years after they bought it, so I didn't see the renovations, but Bill'll bore the hind leg off a donkey if you give him an excuse to talk about the work. I can't imagine them just ignoring something like that. No, my best bet is that they'd never opened the cupboard and didn't know the attic was there. The key was pretty stiff. You'd be forgiven for thinking you had the wrong one. It's only because I'm a stubborn bastard I forced it.
But the poison garden, I said slowly. They did just ignore that, right?
The poison garden?
He looked at me, startled.
How do you know about that?
The girls took me